Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we will talk about a topic certainly we have discussed before, and that is global climate change. We will talk a little bit about where we are now, what we know about it, and also one thing we want to concentrate on is the issue of how it is that we manage development that, on the one hand, gives countries the opportunity to develop and, on the other hand, continues to keep this issue in mind and keep some regard and respect for the environment as countries do develop. And our guest for this hour is Robert Watson. He is chief scientist and also senior advisor for sustainable development at the World Bank. Before joining the World Bank, he was associate director for environment in the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the executive office of the president in the White House. This was during the Clinton administration. And before that, he worked at NASA, where he was director of the science division and chief scientist for the Office of Mission to Planet Earth at NASA. He's been involved in negotiating some key global environment conventions. Between 1997 and 2002, he chaired the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and has been involved in other scientific bodies looking at this issue. He is, by his academic training, a chemist, received his PhD in chemistry from London University, and he's here visiting the campus to talk about the science, economics, and politics of global warming. This is the keynote speech for an event called Environmental Horizons 2007, something that has been happening every year now for a number of years, to show what's going on in the way of environmental activities and studies here at the University of Illinois. And his speech will be at noon today in Illini Room A in the Illini Union. And I am presuming that anyone interested in hearing him should stop by, should feel welcome, that it's open to anybody who would like to attend. And here on this program, if you'd like to give us a call, you can certainly do that. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We just ask callers to be brief just so we can keep moving along. But anyone who's interested is welcome to call. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Appreciate it. I think that I'd like to, again, just kind of review the basics. And I think that as far as climate change is concerned, you know, the one thing that was never really up for debate was the fact that over the last 100 years, average global temperatures have gone up and that the warmest years we have seen have been in the last decade. You can't dispute that because that's about numbers. The things people wanted to argue about was, is this the indication of a trend? Can we expect the Earth to continue to warm? And why is this happening? And particularly, was this the are human beings ultimately the cause, or is this a result of some kind of natural thing that would have happened whether we were here or not? That's the thing that people want to argue, and still, I suppose, in some sense, argue about. Now, just recently, we've had some very significant reports coming out. The consensus seems to be building on one particular point of view. On that question of how much humans are involved, what do we say now?
As you said, there is no doubt that the Earth's climate has become warmer. Precipitation patterns have changed all over the globe. Sea level has risen. Arctic sea ice is melting. Many of the glaciers in the mountains are melting. And so there's no question we are seeing major changes in the Earth's climate. If we try and simulate using sophisticated climate models the last 100 to 150 years, the only way we can explain the observed changes is effectively to invoke human activities. That is to say, over the last 150 years, we've added a significant amount of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane and nitrous oxide, to the atmosphere. We've added some aerosols to the atmosphere, sulfur aerosols. And when we try and simulate the past, we cannot simulate the past record on natural phenomena alone, changing in solar radiation, changes in volcanic activity. We have to invoke human activity. It used to be 5 years ago, we could have a cause and effect relationship between temperature and sort of our actions. But now we're looking at the whole ensemble. In other words, there's a consistency. The temperatures change, the precipitation, sea level, sea ice, mountain glaciers. And the only way we can simulate this whole ensemble of changes is by actually attributing most of those changes to human activities.
Mm-hmm. And the main here thing that we're concerned about in terms of greenhouse gases is carbon dioxide, and that comes from burning fossil fuels?
The main Human-induced greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide, at least 70 to 80% of the problem. And the two sources of carbon dioxide are burning fossil fuels, oil, gas and coal, as well as tropical deforestation. 80% roughly from energy policies, 20% roughly from the way we're deforesting the tropics.
When people think about not only what has happened, but what would be likely to happen within the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, whatever, assuming that we did nothing, assuming that we continue to do what we're doing now, what's anyone's best guess about the trend here? And are we expecting that we'll see more? If indeed we do nothing, are we expecting we'll see more warming?
There's no doubt that more warming is absolutely inevitable. We would project that over the next 100 years, the Earth would become additionally warmer anywhere from 2 to 6 degrees Celsius. So in other words, 3.5 to over 10 degrees Fahrenheit. The high latitudes of the Earth will warm more than the tropics, and the land areas will warm more than the oceans. But there is no doubt that if we do nothing to change our energy policies and technologies, the way we manage our forests and agricultural lands, we would expect to see a significant change, a warming of the Earth's climate. We'd expect sea level to rise even more, mountain glaciers to melt even more, Arctic sea ice to melt even more, and significant changes in precipitation. Some parts of the world getting wetter, other parts of the world getting much drier.
Yeah. One further question, and well, I was going to say I had a caller. I guess they changed their mind. Anyway, I'm sure we'll have some calls. This is something that scientists, environmentalists have been talking about for quite a long time. And it's my understanding that, for example, going back to the time when you were in the White House, you were one of the people that Vice President Gore spent time talking with. And perhaps you were one of those who had an influence on him and his feeling that this was an important issue. This is not new. Is there, though, anything new now about how it is we're talking about this? And particularly if you look at people in government and people who look in big business, how they're addressing this issue?
Yeah. The science of climate change, the basic science, hasn't changed in the last 20 or 30 years. But as we've done more and more research, we've got better and better data, more sophisticated climate models, and our confidence in understanding the causes of the observed change in climate have got stronger. We've also got far more work on what are the implications of a warmer world and changing precipitation patterns. And what we would argue is most people in the world will be adversely affected by climate change. There will be some benefits, but most people will be adversely affected, with developing countries most adversely affected. Decreases in agricultural productivity, less water, less quality of water, an increase potentially in vector-borne diseases such as malaria and dengue, potentially an increase in cholera, a water-borne disease, a reduction in effectively many of the ecosystems being adversely affected, and sea level rise displacing potentially tens of millions of people that live in coastal areas. So our understanding of the climate system is better today, and our understanding of the impact of the climate system on food, water, human health has also improved.
We do have a caller. We have another one coming in. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Robert Watson. He's chief scientist and senior advisor for sustainable development at the World Bank. And he's here visiting the campus to give a talk today at noon. We're talking about global warming. And if you have questions, they are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do have someone in Belgium, a nearby community. And this is line number 4, our toll free line. Hello.
Good morning, sir. Mm-hmm. I would like to state first that this is not meant to be at all personal to your guest, but seems as though the World Bank is definitely partially to blame for this, because they forced a lot of roads into some very pristine areas in the South America and Africa that generally led to deforestation in some areas. We in the Midwest here and the United States cut down a beautiful forest in the eastern side of the United States that caused the problems too. But since the World Bank helped cause this problem, wouldn't it be wise for the World Bank to help generate a hydrogen economy and push tons and tons of money to get totally away from this carbon-based society that we have right now? Seems to me that'd be the best way to solve this problem.
Yeah. It's very clear that many policies, both of OECD countries and the World Bank, have indeed over time helped to exacerbate the problems. As you've said, when you put new roads into a pristine forest, what typically happens is the forest gets cut down, often converted to cattle pastures or to agriculture, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that you get more forests cut down. And that has indeed led to both a loss of biological diversity and a contributor to climate change. What the World Bank is trying to do at the moment is to work with a number of governments and countries to try and see how can they meet the energy needs they have in a cost-effective way, but in a way that is also climate-friendly. So we're working in particular with the big developing countries such as China, India, Brazil, Mexico, South Africa. We're working to see how can they reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, but at the same time meet their energy needs. China and India will use their coal. So the question is, can we use coal and yet at the same time capture the carbon dioxide before it's emitted to the atmosphere so it is effectively climate friendly? Can we improve the way we use renewable energy, solar energy, wind energy, modern geothermal energy, small hydro? Can we improve the way we use our energy, more efficient cars, more efficient houses? And so you're absolutely correct. The World Bank should be working with client countries to try and move the agenda to meet energy needs but do it more climate friendly. The issue of the hydrogen economy is that hydrogen is only a carrier of energy, so you still have to produce the energy. And the question is, how do you produce it? If you produce hydrogen from fossil fuels, it's basically no cleaner. So we need to find a way to produce the hydrogen in a clean manner so that it is an efficient, climate-friendly carrier. The World Bank actually itself doesn't do research. We are a bank. We lend money. And so we clearly are working with governments, with the private sector, to see how can we make a transition to what I would call a low-carbon economy.
I might point out, sir, that we already have the technology to produce energy at least a cleaner method than the carbon-based fossil fuel line, mainly nuclear power, which, though it has its problems, it does not generate carbon dioxide. And I also might point out, sir, that I'm just as guilty as anybody else. I love to take trips to one place or another, but airplanes produce a lot of carbon right at the very top of the atmosphere, which is probably the very worst place it could be. Cutting down on the pollution that produces from airplanes sounds a good place to start, too.
Yeah, two very quick comments. Nuclear power clearly will be an option that's used by a number of governments. It will be used in the US, Russia, China, India, Korea, France, Japan. It's strongly opposed by other countries such as Germany, Sweden, the Netherlands. And so this will be a national decision. It won't be the silver bullet to produce all of the energy, but in many countries it will clearly be part of the solution. But as we both know, there are many people in society that have concerns about nuclear power, the reactor safety, how can you dispose of the waste, and the loss of fissile material to terrorists. But it will indeed be part of the solution. I would agree completely with you, basically. With respect to aircraft, at the moment, probably aircraft emissions account for about 4% of the contribution to climate change. And indeed, it's become a more and more important part of travel. Just an aside, the World Bank staff, of course, travel a lot. And so the World Bank itself in Washington, D.C., is what we call carbon neutral. We offset all of our energy use, both in our buildings and in all of our travel, by buying carbon offsets in developing countries. So we're trying to effectively walk the talk, that we realize that climate change is a serious issue, and we recognize that we do occasionally have to travel by planes, and so we try and buy carbon offsets to make sure that we at least are carbon neutral.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to a caller here on someone on a cell phone. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have tons of questions, but I'll try and just keep it to one. Do you know if there are any initiatives to restructure? I don't know. Agriculture would be like a good example of this, not so much finding new energy sources, but restructuring kind of synergetically to, reduce the energy load. Say we grow corn in Illinois. We don't eat it here. We send it out to Montana, and it gets fed to cows, and they get driven back here, and it gets, sent to General Mills, who turns it into Cocoa Puffs. And is there any talk of, like, just trying to have, I don't know, maybe more economic, not in a money sense, but in a practicality sense, distribution of, you know, how we move food around.
It's quite clear that we need to look very seriously, not only at the energy sector, but the agricultural sector. Two points. First, the agricultural sector has an impact on climate change. We do emit greenhouse gases. When we cut down the forest for more agricultural land, we emit carbon dioxide. Rice production produces methane. Cattle production produces methane. When we fly food, as you point out, from one part of the world to another part of the world, the energy is required to move food either within the United States or to foreign countries. So the agricultural sector is clearly having an impact on climate change. Equally, climate change itself is having an impact on the agricultural sector. As I note, with significant increases in temperature and changes in precipitation, agricultural productivity in many developing countries is likely to decrease. So we need to look very carefully at our agricultural sector of how can we have a system that is essential, of course, to feed the world, I mean, crucial for human nutrition, but at the same time reduce what I call its footprint on the climate sector. One of the areas effectively where we need to think through carefully is effectively can we produce liquid fuels, biofuels, to replace fossil fuels? Now, at the moment, the way we do it is we use maize to turn into ethanol, or we use sugar. In my opinion, this is not a very sensible way to go. It's not particularly economic. We have to subsidize it considerably. And effectively, when you use a lot of maize for biofuels, it actually drives up the price of the maize and actually adversely affects food prices. But there's a future technology called cellulosic ethanol, which is maybe 5-10 years in the future. A lot of research going on here at the University of Illinois. And that might in the future mean that it's an agricultural product that can actually be used to fuel many of our cars. And so we need to think through carefully how we use our energy more differently in the agricultural sector, how maybe the agricultural sector can help to produce some liquid fuels in the future.
If I could follow up just a little bit with the grass-based ethanol, that's really intriguing. But I also wonder, I mean, we've only talked about agriculture like half of it, you know, the runoff for fish kills and things like that. It doesn't even seem to be part of the equation for a lot of people. And I wonder, would that still be a factor when we're talking about non-ethanol-based corn?
Yeah, well, I used to be the co-chair of something called the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, and we looked at what I call the footprint of the agricultural sector, not just on the Earth's climate, but on other ecological or environmental issues. And one of the big challenges is how can we produce the food or fiber that we need, but at the same time using less chemicals, using less pesticides, using less fertilizers. What we acknowledged was that effectively the way we've had our agricultural system in the past is led a lot of runoff of pesticides and fertilizers into the aquatic ecosystems, lakes and into rivers, and all the way down into, say, the Gulf of Mexico in the case of the US, with some fairly adverse effects on ecological systems. So we need to stand back from our agricultural system, ask how can we produce the food we all need in the most cost-effective way, but can we do it in a way that is more environmentally friendly?
Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for the call. Just let me ask you a key question, and I realize that this is difficult, and you've touched on it already. That is this issue of what can be done to help developing countries develop in a way that is sustainable, in a way that where they can meet in a sustainable and environmentally friendly way their need for energy. Of course, there are a lot of other issues that have to do with consumption and waste and so forth. I think some people would make the argument that we have a fundamental problem here if people in those countries, if they truly aspire to the standard of living that we have here in the United States, for example, if all of the people in China had that standard of living, all of the people in India, all of the Earth would just crumble. There is just even if we implemented sustainable technologies, there's no way to do that. Do you think that is true and that there people in the developing world are going to have to settle for a different, we're going to have to, our benchmark for what's an ideal standard of living is going to have to be adjusted?
I'm actually a technological optimist with respect to energy, and I actually do believe that the world could meet its energy needs in a way that is also environmentally friendly. But it does mean to say that we are going to have to produce our energy in a different way and use our energy in a different way. It's true that if India and China today had the same standard of living as the US and they use exactly the same technologies, we would have a horrendous problem. There's no question whatsoever. It's also clear that energy is absolutely essential for economic growth and poverty alleviation. Just to give you a couple of very quick numbers, China last year actually developed and put in place at least 1.5 gigawatts of new power every week. That's a huge amount of power. And to put in comparison, all of sub-Saharan Africa put 1 gigawatt in a year. India, which is growing tremendously, put about 3 to 4 gigawatts in a year. So the economic growth and the demand for energy is absolutely incredible in China. So they have a lot of cheap coal. So the question is, can they produce electricity from coal, but we capture that carbon dioxide before it's emitted into atmosphere? Can their cars effectively, and ours in America, of course, in Europe, can we drive cars that are effectively far more efficient? Fuel cell cars or very, very efficient hybrids? Can we actually have far more mass transportation? Can we manage the way we telecommute better, basically? Can our buildings be much more efficient? I'm an optimist that believes that we can produce our energy in a way that is relatively clean for the climate system, and we can use it much, much more efficiently. But it is a huge challenge. There's a technological challenge. There's also a policy challenge. And there's a behavioral challenge. In the United States, and I don't want to pick on us, I am an American now, we tend to like large cars. We tend to like large houses. We tend to have a lot of gadgets that use electricity. So effectively, there's a behavioral issue of being willing not to change our lifestyle, but at least if we're going to have those gadgets, make them the most energy efficient that we can. But it is a big challenge. India and China desperately need, and other developing countries, desperately need more energy to get themselves out of poverty.
Yeah. Here in the United States, we have a significant we have significant coal resources. Here we do here in the state of Illinois. The problem with coal that we have is that it's very high sulfur coal. So research is going on to this question of, can we burn that coal in a way and deal with the pollutants? Can we do some kind of sequestration? When it burns, we grab the carbon dioxide, we'll stick it someplace. You're a chemist. Do you think that the kinds of research that's going on has promise, and that coal is an energy resource that can be used in an environmentally friendly way?
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put out a paper about 2 years ago, year and a half ago, on the whole issue of carbon capture and storage. That is to say, you produce the electricity from coal or from gas, but you capture the carbon dioxide and subduct it either into saline aquifers, depleted oil wells, depleted gas wells. And they were relatively optimistic, but fully realized we have to do far more research. I had breakfast this morning, someone from the geology department here at the university. They were somewhat more cautious about it. So what I would simply say is, this is an area where we really need to push the research very aggressively to see whether it is or is not a viable way forward. If indeed carbon capture and storage is viable, that is to say we can subduct it in saline aquifers or depleted oil and gas wells, then I'm optimistic we can use the coal in a relatively climate-friendly manner. If we can't, then I become much more cautious and pessimistic. It's not clear to me we could meet the energy needs of the world just simply from modern renewable energy, nuclear power, large hydropower. I believe coal and gas will be a major part of the energy mix for the next 50 years. Therefore, we've got to find a way to make it climate friendly.
We have several callers. We'll get right to them and take them in the order that they came in. We're about midway through the conversation here, and I would like to introduce again the guest for anyone who might have just tuned in. We're talking with Dr. Robert Watson. He is the chief scientist and senior advisor for sustainable development at the World Bank. Before joining the World Bank, that was in 1996, he worked in the White House as an environmental advisor. And before that, he worked at NASA, where he was director of the science division and also chief scientist for the Office of mission to planet Earth. He is a chemist by his academic training, and he is here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk. This is an event for Environmental Horizons 2007, sponsored by the Environmental Council. It's an annual showcase of the depth and breadth of environmental activities here at the U of I, and he'll be giving a talk on the science, economics, and politics of global warming at noon today in Illini Room A of the Illini Union. Questions here on the program are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. The lines are full, so we'll get right back to it, and we'll start with someone in Urbana and line two. Hello?
Yes, I was wondering on the emission of greenhouse gases, what is the time frame for measuring that? Like, can that be measured on a daily basis?
Yes, it can actually be measured on an hourly basis. There's some very, very sophisticated instruments that can measure the amount of carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide in the atmosphere. There are measurement stations all over the world that measure it. So we have very, very accurate measurements of the amount of carbon dioxide and these other greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere. Since about 1958, we've got some very excellent measurements of carbon dioxide. So we know exactly what the trend is within actually a few tenths of a percent. We can see that effectively there are annual cycles that reflect the uptake and release of carbon dioxide from the forests of the world. And so we've got very good measurements over the last, say, 50-odd years. But also we've got measurements that go back 600,000 years. What we can do is we can actually analyze the chemical composition of the air bubbles that are trapped in ice in both Greenland and in Antarctica. And so we can drill down a couple of miles and effectively analyze what actually the gas composition was over the last 600,000 years. And you can actually see how carbon dioxide went up and down as you went from a glacial to an interglacial period, 180 parts per million in a glacial period, about 280 million parts per million in an interglacial period. And today we're at 380. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've increased carbon dioxide from about 280 parts per million to 380. We can also see what's happened to methane and the other greenhouse gases. So very, very accurate measurements.
So again, going back to this question of human activity, yes, if you look back far enough, you can see cycles. It does go up and down, but there is a significant, noticeable, unmistakable blip that happens at when the Industrial Revolution happens.
Absolutely. The carbon dioxide had never been above 280 parts per million in the period of the last 600,000 years. Today it's gone from 280 to 380. Not only that, we can look at the isotopic composition of the carbon dioxide and show that most of it has come from what we call fossil carbon, which is dead carbon. That means it's come from oil, gas, and coal, basically. So very good understanding, not only of the change, but the cause of the change.
All right, let's go to line number three. This is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
I have a couple of issues I was hoping that your guest could address. I was wondering, first of all, if there are any countries that are actively encouraging less meat consumption as a way of battling climate change. You might have touched on that when you were talking about agriculture, but I had to tune out for just a minute. And the other issue is there's always a lot of focus on energy efficiency, how to make our how to get more miles out of a gallon of gas in our cars, for example. But we don't seem to talk about reducing the need for driving, for example, by making cities more walkable and cyclable. There is a lot of work on this in Europe, but in North America we seem to have sort of missed the boat on that. And having traveled in Tanzania, I saw that even though hardly anybody there can afford a car, things still seem to be being built more for cars than for pedestrians. So I will hang up and listen to your comments offline.
All right.
Yeah, both of your points are very valid. I don't know of us personally of a single country in the world that is advocating less meat from a perspective of climate change. I think a lot of information is going out there of maybe less meat, a more balanced diet, more vegetables, more fruits would be make us more healthy. Obviously, the more meat we eat, there are some health issues. At the same time, it also does mean that you have to have a lot of fodder for the cattle, and therefore it is a major contribution to greenhouse gases, basically the amount of food, the methane effectively that is basically belched by cows. But I know of no country that is advocating less meat because of the climate change issue. On the issue of energy efficiency, you've brought up a very good point. most American cities are not designed very easily for walking or for bicycling, and most don't have very good mass transport systems. Obviously, New York is an exception. San Francisco and Washington, D.C. have reasonable underground systems, but nothing extensive like Tokyo, Paris, London, and other cities. And so in reality, what we need to reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases from the transport sector is cities that have effectively got a much better plan with bicycle lanes, maybe more friendly for walking, good mass transport systems so people want to use them as they do in London and Paris, more efficient cars, and actually maybe, as I say, if we could make second generation biofuels work, that as well. So it's a combination. But if you go to Copenhagen or Amsterdam, your biggest concern as a pedestrian is being run over by a bicycle, not being run over by a car. So your points are well taken.
All right. And then we'll go to another caller here. This would be in Chicago. This is line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. What kind of plants or trees produce the most, use the most carbon dioxide to get rid of it?
Oh, I mean, any tree or any plant clearly to grow will absorb carbon dioxide. Trees in the tropics grow faster. So effectively, if one was to try and reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere through what I call afforestation or reforestation, that is growing more trees, the best place to do it clearly would be in the tropics, where effectively you can effectively have 200, what we call 200 tons at least of carbon in the trees per acre, basically. And so the best place to sort of try and absorb some of the carbon dioxide would be growing fast growing trees in the tropics.
Back in the 30s, we had something called the CCC, and they took all these young punks that were out of work and shipped us all out to Montana, and we cleared trees and planted trees. Why can't they do that with these people that are down and out and low income and put them to work doing something like that? That would help a little bit, wouldn't it?
I mean, that's clearly a social issue, basically, and would clearly need a government intervention policy. But, I mean, I think the basic idea of are there ways we can, well, whoever it is, can use our land better, plant trees, is clearly something that would move us in the right direction. How one would accomplish that has got a lot of social implications.
It sure didn't hurt us to ship these punks out to Montana. We never saw that part of the world, and we all enjoyed it and worked hard and didn't hurt us a bit. That was back in the 30s. It was the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps. Maybe a few of your readers would remember those days. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, let's go on here to Champaign and another caller. This is line number 1. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah, as tempted as I am to ask you about how Paul Wolfowitz's scandal is causing problems for the World Bank, I'll keep to science. In response to earlier caller who talked about the effect of airline travel, scientists had a unique opportunity in the aftermath of 9/11, who were studying this issue, to get a baseline reading of what the effect of the contrails produced by airplanes were. And it was astonishing to me. As I recall, I may be misremembering these figures, but it was something like 11 to 18% reduction in the amount of energy from the sun reaching the surface of the Earth by being reflected back by the contrails, and you know that masking somewhat the effect of CO2 buildup. And I know it's somewhat different, but similar issue of particulate matter that we're spewing up in the atmosphere is also masking the effect of the buildup of CO2. And so as these things are cleaned up, that's going to, speed up the warming effect of the CO2 in the atmosphere. And I'm wondering if your calculations are taking that into account.
Yes, you brought up some very good points, of course. With respect to aircraft, they actually contribute either positively or negatively to climate change in several ways. One, of course, they emit carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, causes warming. And the aircraft industry roughly contributes about 4% of all of the greenhouse gas emissions. And that's actually comparable to all of the continent of Africa. So the aircraft industry is as important as of all of the continent of Africa, just to put it in perspective, and a bit more than a country like the United Kingdom. Secondly, they also put out nitrogen oxides, nitrogen dioxide. That effectively can get converted to ozone, which is also a greenhouse gas. They also occasionally put out particulates, and that actually offsets some of the global warming through, as you said, reflection of incoming solar radiation back to space. And they, of course, do produce, under certain circumstances, contrails. Your number seems a little high to me about the effect of the contrails on the incoming radiation, but I'll have to be honest, I can't remember the numbers. I think this is an area where we need a bit better research to understand the exact implications of contrails on the radiative balance of the Earth's atmosphere. But overall, your point is that aircraft are a factor, and we need to take that into account. And indeed, the climate models do take this into account to the degree they can. They don't do a good job on contrails. They clearly take into account, however, the issue of carbon dioxide, the emissions of oxides and nitrogen. What you also pointed out is that when effectively we burn fuel, whether it's gas, whether it's jet fuel, or whether it's coal in our power plants, we often put sulfur into the atmosphere. The sulfur gets converted into sulfate aerosols, and those sulfate aerosols do, as you say, reflect some of the incoming solar radiation back to space, and they actually partially mask the impact of the greenhouse gases. All of those are taken into account in all of the climate models. And as effectively we are cleaning up the coal when we burn it in power plants, there is now less and less of an offsetting factor. And as you point out, if we truly clean up the production of energy so we don't have sulfur emissions, it will actually make the climate situation slightly worse. So in other words, the sulfur pollution is partly masking the global warming effect of the greenhouse gases. And we actually project over the next 50 years that more and more countries around the world will do what the US is doing, and that is to reduce the sulfur emissions because of local and regional air pollution effects. And if anything, that will exacerbate the global warming.
With respect to the contrail issue, this was something I saw on a PBS special that I said I can't remember the numbers, but actually I was surprised at how high they were. So you might want to check that, because they were much higher than I would have intuitively thought that they would be.
There was an intergovernmental panel change report on aircraft industry about 7-8 years ago. I was the overall chair, and we did look at the issue of contrails. I just actually forget the numbers, to be quite honest, but it is an issue that much of the scientific community is at least looking at.
Right, thank you.
Thanks. Just how important is it that we have international conventions and governments go on the record as saying, yes, we think that it's important, yes, we recognize what's going on here, and that what we're going to do is to make some kind of a commitment. We're actually going to say so publicly. We're going to sign a piece of paper that says, yes, we're making a commitment to, here in our country, reduce our contribution to the greenhouse gas problem.
I personally believe it's absolutely essential, and that is, if we want to address the climate change issue and limit the change in the Earth's climate, which I believe is absolutely essential, then clearly we need to get all countries to reduce their emissions. Even if you had emission reductions in America or Europe, but you don't have them in developing countries, we can't eventually stabilize the Earth's climate. So we need to have emissions reductions, at least in all countries that have major emissions. That would be all industrialized countries, the US, Europe, Russia, Japan. But more and more over time, we will also need India and China and other large developing countries to also reduce their projected emissions. The big issue is equity. Given that 80% of all of the greenhouse gases that have been put into the atmosphere due to human activities come from the industrialized countries, which are only 20% of the world's population, is it fair to ask India and China today to have the same obligations as Europe or North America when developing countries have 80% of the world's population and have only put 20% of the greenhouse gases in? So the big challenge is, what is fair? What is equitable? What should the US do? What should Europe do, Russia and developing countries? So we need to find an equitable solution, but it will require all of us working together. One country alone isn't going to make any difference. So it's what we call an issue of the global commons. You can only address it if we all act together.
And what I think that one of the main objections in the United States, particularly by the Bush administration, to this kind of agreement, to signing on, is their assertion that this would be to do that would be very damaging to the economy of the United States.
Yeah, many of us have looked at that particular issue. I'm not an economist, but the IPCC looked at this very carefully. We totally disagree with that particular assumption. And indeed, there's a report put out by Nicholas Stern, currently worked for the UK government, used to be the chief economist in the World Bank, and before that, the chief economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And Nicholas put together a wide range of economists to work with him. The final conclusion they came up to was it was much, much cheaper to mitigate, that is to reduce, greenhouse gas emissions than to adapt to climate change. And in fact, we've looked to see what could the impact be effectively on not acting versus the cost of acting. And effectively, the recent IPCC report said that for a 4 degrees Celsius increase in temperature, there could be a 1 to 5% loss of net global domestic product. And yet, that's the cost of inaction. The cost of acting probably would be less than 1% of GDP. So the general view at the moment is it's cheaper to mitigate than to adapt. And there are a lot of technological options to start to move down that pathway.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Robert Watson. He is Chief Scientist and Senior Advisor for Sustainable Development at the World Bank, and we're talking about global climate change. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone here next in Urbana. This is line 2. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Watson. I've been asking guests who David has interviewed recently on this subject, if they are aware of any direct political interference from people in the Bush administration on the scientific research and getting this research out to print and broadcast media. Do you have any personal experience with this?
I left the White House about 11 years ago, and I've worked in the World Bank, and so I haven't directly interacted with the current administration. I will say the U.S. government, through its U.S. Global Change Program, probably has the largest research program in the world, and so whether it's been under Democratic presidents or Republican, the commitment to understand the issue is probably greater in the United States than any other country in the world. However, I've also read, of course, in newspapers how several documents produced by either US EPA or by some individual scientists have been censored. Jim Hansen, yes, who is a scientist from the Goddard Institute of Space Sciences in New York, who personally I know very well and a very honest and honorable person, has been on 60 Minutes and a couple of other television programs arguing that his research has been censored. So I have no personal experience of it, but I've seen scientists that I know who are very honest and straightforward have claimed that some of their research has at least been, in their view, censored. That's all I can say.
Thank you.
All right. And line 1, this is, I think, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes. I agree we need to do something about global warming, but a little person like me can't do anything. It's up to the companies. For example, I was used to buying Alaskan salmon that was processed in Alaska, and now then it's shipped to China and come back. Look at all the global warming, the carbon dioxide that's done by shipping Alaska fish from Alaska to China and back, and then we've had this big pet food scare with the, I think, wheat gluten. It's in the pet food. Now I saw on TV this morning, it's got the hog farms. What's wrong with American wheat gluten? Look at all the carbon dioxide that's done by shipping this and that, and flowers come in from Brazil and Holland in place of local flowers. We need the companies to stop all this free world trade. That's my comment.
All right. Well, there's sort of two things about globalization. And then also I'm interested in your reflection on the comment of someone who would say that I as an individual can't do anything about it.
Yeah, two issues. I think we need action at all levels. In other words, we as individuals can do some things. We can indeed turn off lights when we leave the room, turn off the television set, use our energy-efficient light bulbs. We can, of course, have smaller cars or use hybrid cars, although I do recognize they're more expensive. So we as individuals can make decisions to reduce our energy use. We absolutely need the large companies to both produce energy more efficiently and effectively to use it more efficiently. But we do have companies like General Electric, Walmart, DuPont, who've actually all signed up to being much more energy efficient and also to produce technologies that are more energy efficient. So we do have a significant number of the private sector companies that are moving in the right direction, but we as individuals can do something. We're seeing states like California with Schwarzenegger pushing for much more energy efficient use. We're seeing the Northeast states. We're seeing some of the religious movements who are also arguing that we should become more climate friendly. So there's a very large spectrum of people in society, from the private sector to individuals to governments that are arguing to move forward. So I think all of us can do something to effectively help to be more energy efficient. Now, the basic point of yours about moving food all the way around the world or flowers, etc., I fully understand. But to be quite honest, what's happening is we as Americans often demand strawberries all 12 months of the year. We demand fresh flowers all 12 months of the year. Now, the only way you can get strawberries all 12 months of the year is often to import them from sort of the tropics where they'll grow when it's our winter. Or if we demand flowers all of the year, we have to import them. So in many respects, the market is responding to what we're demanding. And so I have a lot of sympathy and empathy for what you're saying. If we only use local goods when they're in season, well, they normally taste better, actually. But we would reduce this large transport of food and flowers from all over the world. But in reality, the market is responding to what we are asking for as consumers.
Let's talk with at least one more caller, Atlanta, Illinois, line number 4. This is our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. This conversation has opened up a whole new can of worms, and the fact that I haven't thought about is that what you mentioned a few callers ago, the possibility of actually blocking sun's radiation into the Earth due to the aircraft contrails and other items of the aerosol-type things that you talked about. I mean, since all our energy originates from the sun, and photosynthesis is a major part of life here, that sounds like another absolute negative, even though it might be helping global warming as far as cutting down on the greenhouse effect. It's definitely not a good thing.
One of the approaches that has been thought of by some people, which I don't like, is if you put more aerosols into the Earth's atmosphere, sulfate aerosols or other particulates, you could reflect some of the incoming solar radiation and therefore maintain the Earth's climate as it is today. Another idea is to put huge reflectors out in space and reflect a small amount. You wouldn't have to reflect much, a small amount of incoming radiation. These approaches, the aerosol one I truly don't like at all. It's using one pollutant to offset another pollutant. The reflectors in space seem to be a technological fix when we don't need it. That is to say, we can produce the energy we need, in my opinion, in a much more climate-friendly way by renewable energy, as I've said already, more efficient use of energy. So my feeling is we should take the climate change issue very seriously. And we should look to see, can we produce and use our energy better? And can we manage our land better? Only if all of that fails should we be thinking of these big geoengineering solutions like putting reflectors in space, etc.
Well, isn't it true right now that the Earth, you know, is using most of the sunlight it gets for photosynthesis? And if we did block that somewhat, you know, that's going to not necessarily human life, but that's going to have an effect on all life, particularly on trees and other things if we were able to block that sunlight.
You'd only have to modify it by about, I might get the number wrong, but about 1% or so. My guess is it wouldn't have a serious effect if we were to block a 1% of the incoming solar radiation or thereabouts. However, I haven't seen any good calculations or models that would actually look at this in detail, but my guess is it would not be a serious issue. But again, we'd be solving one environmental issue and potentially causing another, as you're suggesting. And so my view is, as I just said, we should look at the better ways to produce and use energy and use our land.
Well, great conversation. I really, really appreciate it. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. We got one more caller here. We'll have to be quick. Line two, Kankakee. Go ahead.
A note perhaps of interest to listeners. Kankakee Community College is engaged in a series of programs on the subject under discussion, and Kankakee Community College will apparently have a continuing involvement with the study of solutions for climate change.
Good.
Thank you.
All right. Excellent. Well, we're just upon the point we're going to have to finish. Is there a last thought that you'd like to leave with folks? I think we've covered an awful lot of territory here.
I'd simply say that human-induced climate change is a very serious environmental and development issue that affects both developed and developing countries. There are cost-effective solutions. We as individuals can use our energy more efficiently, and we can advocate to our political representatives to try and move aggressively forward on putting in place the policies that can reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we can put pressure on the private sector to produce and use the energy in a much cleaner way.
Right. Well, our guest this morning for this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Robert Watson, he's the chief scientist and senior advisor for sustainable development at the World Bank. He's here visiting the campus. He will be the keynote speaker for Environmental Horizons 2007, sponsored by the Environmental Council, to showcase some of the environmental activities going on the U of I campus. He'll be speaking at noon in Illini Room A at the Illini Union on the science, economics, and politics of global warming. So anyone who is interested can hear him. Also, you might want to, while you're there, take in the Environmental Open House between 1 and 3. They're also in the Illini Union, where they will showcase some student environmental research and outreach efforts. That's all happening today on the University of Illinois campus. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure.